Good morning. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I'm calling this remote meeting of the House Preventing Homelessness Division to order. We'll start with the clerk taking the roll to determine which members are present.
Good morning, Chair Gomez.
Gomez present.
Gomez present. Vice Chair Keeler.
Keeler present.
Vice Chair Keeler present. New Brindley.
New Brindley present.
New Brindley present. Davids.
Davids present.
Davids present. Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Hollins.
Hollins present.
Hollins present. Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Howard. Howard.
Howard present.
Howard present. Hagel.
Present.
Hagel present. Petersburg.
Petersburg present.
Petersburg present. Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. We have a quorum.
Thank you so much. Next, we'll do the minutes. Representative Keeler, did you have a chance to review the minutes from our February 2nd meeting?
I did, Madam Chair. So moved.
So Representative Keeler has moved approval of the minutes for February 2nd, 2022. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please unmute for a moment and say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Well, that was so good. Any opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the minutes for February 2nd, 2022 are adopted. Our committee was actually my first committee of the session. But I have three committees on Wednesday. So after we did our committee, I went to my other committees and I was like, oh my God, I'm such a jerk. I didn't introduce our staff. We have a bunch of new staff. So I wanted to welcome Robin Schmidt, who's our new committee legislative assistant and who has already, hi Robin, do you wanna just say hello, say where you live?
Hello everybody, great to be here. And I live in Plymouth.
Perfect. Robin has already adjusted to the Greg Davids method of attendance taking where she says our name and I back. So thank you so much. I know that was a specific instruction, but we like to adhere to that. Next, Chelsea Axelson is our new GOP researcher. Welcome, Chelsea. You want to just say hi to folks? You don't have to tell us where you live. Maybe that's rude.
I'm Chelsea. I live in Champlin, so.
Excellent. Welcome. Thank you. Justin Cope is joining us from House Research. You want to say hi, Justin?
Yeah, hi, I'm Justin Cope. I'm the new legislative analyst with House Research, and I live in Osseo.
Excellent. And Joe Harney is our House Fiscal Analyst.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Joe Harney. I am a House Fiscal Analyst responsible for Health and Human Services and Housing, and I live in Minneapolis.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Welcome, and welcome back to our returning staff. Sean Herring is our CA. And Molly Peterson is the DFL researcher. So today we're going to talk about shelter capital. And so, you know, about the needs to build more emergency shelter around the state. I will tell you that, you know, of course, I have a lot of conversations with groups, you know, both in my community and around the state about like what the highest needs are, because we know that, you know, there are great needs in this community and you know, we don't have the resources devoted right now to meet all of those needs. And one of the most consistent things that we hear is that there's a need, especially in greater Minnesota, for just more shelter, more emergency shelter. What happens when, you know, when somebody isn't able to kind of stabilize in their home community, if there isn't sort of a network or a web of there to catch them, you know, if they're in a really hard spot temporarily, for example, you know, we have a lot of people who come to the metro or come to Duluth or, you know, in St. Louis County, kind of disconnect from their home communities, disconnect potentially from support and family that they have there, and come to a new place, which presents a bunch of different challenges. And so that's kind of the topic of our committee today. And first up, we're going to hear about a project, a specific project that's in Representative Hassan's ward. Simpson Housing is an agency that serves Minneapolis, but also serves as this really important kind of hub in the web of homelessness response services. So we're joined today by the Executive Director of Simpson Housing Services, Steve Horsfield. And I just want to say that, you know, again, just like we're going to talk about a building, right, that Simpson Housing is working on and has been, you know, raising funds for. But I first kind of came to know Mr. Horsfield when he and Simpson stepped up to provide services in the Navigation Center, which was a response to the Wall of Forgotten Natives that you may have heard about, which was in Minneapolis, sort of our highest profile kind of not first encampment, because there have always been encampments, but it was a highly visible encampment that and the city kind of partnered with a bunch of community organizations to respond to that emergency. And so that was when I first came to know Mr. Horsfield, and he really stepped in again to provide as a hub in this web, or I don't know how to think of it, right? It's like there's this kind of Simpson is part of the connective tissue of emergency shelter response in our city, in our core cities, and so therefore across the state. And you know, when we were working on the indoor villages, he came on board to help us kind of think through how to best serve that community. And he really, you know, has thought through and dealt upfront with a lot of the challenges related to emergency shelters. So all of which is to say, we're really just pleased and grateful to have him joining us and for all of the work that Mr. Horsfield and that Simpson has done in our communities. So Mr. Horsfield, welcome to the committee. If you wanna introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Gomez and committee members. I appreciate you having me here with you today. And my name is Steve Horsfield. I serve as executive director with Simpson Housing Services, and will be 10 years in that role coming up here in a couple of months. And as Chair Gomez mentioned, this I do want to start by acknowledging that we get to operate in a deeply, deeply collaborative network of community providers. And I appreciate not only my peer agencies, but also our really valuable government relationships, the partnerships that we have at the state, the county, and the local level, all of which really enable various elements of this work that would not be possible otherwise at different points in time. So to jump right into the heart of why I'm here today, I want to make sure that I keep this up front. My associates, Shep Harris and Jeff Hayden would be tell me that I was being remiss if I was not very clear about the fact that I'm here very, very specifically in pursuit of filling a funding gap on the shelter capital side of our project. And we're looking for $4 million, preferably in cash appropriation would be ideal to help us fill this gap. And we're also willing to certainly look at all the options for how we can do that. And the reason for this request at this time is literally timing. We've got in the context of these sorts of projects and this sort of work, we are in sort of a shovel-ready state, if you will. We've been working very hard over the course of the last couple of years to get to this point. We one of the big catalysts was a very exciting announcement. There is a supportive housing element to our project, so we were very pleased to receive an $11.1 million award notice from MHFA recently for towards the housing component of this project. So overall, we're getting to about the 70% mark on funding, and really needing to solve for this shelter capital gap. And just to provide a little bit of backstory on that, this is something that we started approaching the legislature on as a bonding request 2 or 3 years ago, and have been kind of moving it along very slowly as other funding sources have been coming online, and we've been getting closer to the finish line. In the past couple of years, the city and the county stepped up with us this past year and awarded us $3.5 million each towards the shelter capital side of things from ARPA funds. Going towards that, what originally had been sort of a $10 million ask that we were trying to solve for, now it's 11 because of increased costs. So we're looking for that $4 million component to get us to where we need to be on the shelter capital side, and which is kind of a good segue for how we got here. The Simpson's been operating emergency shelter for 40 years, and this has all been done pretty much exclusively at the expense of the private fundraising and faith community to support our shelter operation, which is not uncommon for a lot of organizations around town. But it really is time to step in a much more significant way, I think, in terms of the value of these services to the community, and asking for some tangible government support around capital in particular. So we've been running shelter for about 40 years. We have very much of a relationship-based approach. My favorite way of looking at shelter and of explaining this to folks is that someone shows it up at our doorstep, new to homelessness, looking to figure out kind of where do I go from here, and our shelter manager Robert Hoffman will sit them down and say, okay, all right, Steve, you know, I see that you've had a crisis, you've lost housing. What does a 90-day trajectory back towards stable housing look like for you? And then what do we have to do to help you get there? And that conversation is the basis of our relationships with our shelter guests. That is the basis of our shelter programming, because that's really how it works, is one person taking another person by the hand, walking them out the door, advocating with landlords, dealing with, you know, unlawful detainer things, working on stable income, working towards education goals. A third of our shelter guests on any given night are actually working. And just need that advocacy to get over the hump, and to help them get to a position where they can get a little assistance to support to be able to engage in our extremely expensive housing market, those sorts of things. So our little 70-bed shelter that we operate there, on our best years, we're getting about 150 people out the door back into permanent housing each year out of that shelter, and we're really excited to continue to build upon those outcomes. So what happened then was, so 40 years we've been running this thing. A few years ago, the church that was our legacy, where we came out of, came to us and said, hey, we can see a point where we're going to sunset our worship services, and we'd like to consider granting the building to you, to preserve our legacy of community engagement and social justice. And our board took that under consideration and really came back and said, yes, we want to accept this gift for two reasons. One is that we think that we can see a world with a new building where we can serve our guests with more dignity. And we think we can improve upon our housing placement outcomes with a 24-hour facility, with some specific design elements, and with adding housing to the project. At that point in time, We initiated a national research effort working with the Washington office of HUD, working with international consultants, working with the Humphrey School grad students, really pulling all the threads we could. And naively at that point in time, I thought that that we were going to find something that they were going to say to us, hey, you know, there's a wonderful model in Dayton, Ohio, or in Portland, Oregon, and all you got to do is replicate that. And really, we found a couple of useful design elements. But at the end of the day, what we found is that no one was doing anything more or anything better than we're doing here. And so we really had to kind of buckle down and delve into how do we want to design this ourselves based on our local experiences. And as Chair Goldman has mentioned, the timing of that was pretty much right at the point where we had an opportunity to step into this navigation center space. And without belaboring the point of that, we took in about 175 folks on the front end, really challenging set of circumstances with everybody having been sleeping outside and having all of the shared trauma of that experience. But at the end of the day, the real powerful message that came from that experience was that when we opened that thing in December, closed it down by June 1st, and we had placed about 100 people into permanent housing in that 6-month window, it was there was no question at that point that low barrier, service rich shelter environment works. You know, it was another validation for all of the work that we had been doing. It really gave us an opportunity to stretch our legs a little bit more into this 24-hour service environment model, and really see what we can do when we don't close during the day. Because that's the fun. The ironic thing is that we were housing 150 folks a year out of our shelter on the best years, and that's, you know, that was being closed during business hours because we would shut down at 9 a.m. and reopen at 5 p.m. So the navigation center gave us an opportunity to really prove out some more elements about how to have about how best to structure things with service partners on site, about how to make use of 24-hour operations, and really to demonstrate some good results. We then took some of those lessons as we've in the last couple of years, getting toward now, and really tried to take some of the learnings and contribute that to the work that Avivo has done at Avivo Villages, which is 100 units, you know, that's targeting folks who have been outside for a long time and really wanted to. A lot of the work around shelter for me, I will just tell you, just to put it in plain language, is to say that I know that there's people that avoid our shelter system, that are making choices not to come inside. And that kills me. I mean, Minnesota in the wintertime, I mean, if someone's making a decision not to access a resource that gets them indoors, we got some problems. And so the nature of the work that's been happening most recently with the Indoor Villages Project and with the American Indian Community Development Corporation Homeward Bound Project has been diversification. So what I'm happy to say is that we have a much more diverse array of shelter tools now. And our project at Simpson, where we see this fitting is really kind of taking that diversity is good. We've been doing all of that. Now let's get back to work on nuts and bolts and just overall quality of the experience. And we think that we've got the right quality model, the right service structure, the combination of shelter with permanent housing, such that we hope that this will become the first of many in a network that are on transit ways, that are in mixed use neighborhoods where people want to be, that are of an appropriate scale where we can do that relationship-based work, you know, around 70, 80 beds, and do more of those and less of the big warehouse facilities that we have come to rely upon in some of our communities. We're looking for $4 million in shelter capital. Giving you a little bit of some of the nuts and bolts of kind of how we got here and what the design looks like. It's 70 units of shelter and it's 42 units of supportive housing on top of the shelter. And I'm happy to take questions. And it looks like maybe Representative, I'm sorry, I can't read all of your last name, Heather.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Mr. Horsfield. I appreciate it. Thanks for being here. I didn't do a great job of introducing the project because we don't have a bill in front of us that we're hearing right now, but where there's a little bit of a backup with the revisor's office, but this request will be going to the Capital Investment Committee. And just for a little bit more context, last year, Mr. Horsfield and I and some others worked on a bonding request for this project that was $10 million. But what's happened in the intervening, 7 or 8 months is that they've successfully brought on $6 million in ARPA funds from the city of Minneapolis and Hennepin County. And so this really is kind of like we're trying, in addition to a robust capital campaign. So with this, we're really, we're trying to fill this last little gap to get this really important project over the finish line. And so apologies for not mentioning that at the front. And the other piece that, just because you talked so much, Mr. Horsfield, about shelter, about the barriers that people face in accessing shelter and about sort of some of the things that we've learned, you mentioned this low barrier service rich model, culturally responsive models, a 24-hour access, harm reduction, sort of it being accessible by transit and in a community that's desirable. I just wanted to remind us that, last year we passed our Representative Vice Chair Keeler's Shelter Task Force, and that task force has been meeting regularly. They need a little bit more time, but they really are doing incredible work to help kind of, bring us a little bit more information about, as we're moving forward with this capital request about the kind of things that we should be looking for in building. So thank you so much. And Vice Chair Keeler, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Horsfield. I do have a couple questions. Just as we sit and listen in this committee, a couple things have come up. I think being diverse is wonderful. I'm not going to hit on that. One of the areas I think we don't talk a lot about, though, is accessibility for individuals with mobility issues. It's one of the things that, as I talk in spaces about shelters and as we're building programs, can you talk a little bit about individuals with mobility concerns or extra supports? How would you fit their needs? That's my first question. My second question is storage of items. That's another thing that a lot of people say, they don't want to go into a space because they don't want to risk losing all of their items. So can you talk a little bit about what storage for their items and security for items might look like as well? Thank you.
Mr. Horsfield?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. So first of all, accessibility is an excellent question. So that is one of the things about our facility that is a vast improvement over our current facility, which is to say that it is fully accessible. We do have some specialty niches for folks with physical disabilities. There's a new project going up right now with our partners at Catholic Charities for medical respite. There are some elements that allow for folks with disabilities to not have to enter into the kind of straight up homeless response facilities, which I, same with vets. I mean, wherever there's better resources, I want to make sure we're seeing folks being served. That being said, that is, again, one of the reasons why we feel like this is a best practice model, is it is fully accessible. And we would envision this being a network of a part of a network of more of the same. Oh, and storage, God, it's a great question. We could talk all day about storage. What I can tell you is that our current guests, another thing that Simpson does is we operate something called the Adult Shelter Connect office. So we do all of the intake for all of the shelters in Hennepin County. Simpson staff coordinate that each day. And with that, we were able to specialize our shelter as an extended stay shelter. So folks come to us initially for a 90-day stay, and what they get is a locker. And so as long as they've got a bed with us, they've got a locker, they can leave their belongings on site. They don't need to take them out with them during the day. And that's really where we find the place where we can be of value and where our guests really seem to appreciate that value of having a safe place for their things to be while they're out taking care of the business of life.
Thank you, Mr. Horsfield. Vice Chair Keeler, anything else?
No, that's great. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Hornstein.
Thank you so much. Sorry about that. I have a little echo here. Madam Chair, I appreciated your comments about transit, and I wanted to also build on Mr. Horsfield's comments about that too. How does public transit play in your work and the role that you play in the broader community? And again, Mr. Horsfield, thank you so much for your work. It's really inspiring and we support it so much.
Mr. Horsfield?
Thank you. And thank you for your support. There is no conversation about a facility like this without public transit at the center of the conversation. So this particular facility is on two major transit corridors, a block off of Nicollet and along 28th. The temporary shelter that we'll be going into while we do construction is our primary location that we're considering is also on Nicollet. I cannot emphasize enough to folks when we talk about these sort of facilities, the downtown, the Adult Shelter Connect office, again, on the main transitway coming down Third Avenue. In order for this to be of value to our guests, and again, especially when a third of them are working at any given point in time, public transit at the doorstep as best possible is the right solution for these sorts of facilities.
Thank you, and I appreciate your pointing out the working nature of many of your guests.
Thank you. Representative New Brindley?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Horsfield. This is really interesting. You had mentioned that you have about 100, and maybe I just missed it, and I apologize if I missed it, but you had mentioned that you have about 150 people each year that you are able to get out the door and move into stable housing. Do you have an idea of what a typical sort of length of stay is for your guests? And what does it take? I would just be interested in hearing your experience, what it takes to really be able to help move those folks into stable housing.
Mr. Horsfield.
Thank you. Good question. I appreciate that. So, when we set up our shelter as an extended stay shelter with a primary stay of 90 days, that was very specifically by design because we have found that on average, that's about what that arc takes. Someone comes into us, begins working with case managers. We begin assessing the communities where they want to be and what the resources are required. And it's about a 90-day process back to stable housing. So that is about the right window. And we can extend that a little bit. But it is our average length of stay for guests coming through, moving out into permanent housing is like 93, this is actually pre-COVID days, so it's probably a little bit longer now, but you know what I'm saying. 90 to 100 days is about the average length of stay for a shelter guest. And I cannot emphasize this point enough, there are as many answers to the second part of your question as there are human beings coming through. I'm really being serious. So we have, honest to God, we have guests who, we have a very, very limited engagement, like 3 months, we know them. We do that advocacy with the landlord, we get them out the door, we get them over the hump to get into a place, and that's it. They're gone. They're good. We never hear from them again. There was a gentleman who was a good friend of ours who supported and kind of remained part of our community for years and years and years, happened to be a veteran of the armed services who he came to us and his story before he came to us was one of not really sure, when he was going to be able to kind of put down the bottle and stop that fight. Eventually, he was able to get that demon under control to a certain degree when he was in shelter with us. We got him out, got him into permanent housing. And after like 2 years in permanent housing, he came back to us and said one day, I'm done. I've taken that as far down as I can go. But you know, he was in permanent housing, and then continued to receive support services, for a good 5-6 years, after that. So, I mean, it really runs a very, very broad gamut of experiences, because people are unique.
Thank you.
Representative New Brindley, anything else?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifier. I think you have a lot of knowledge, and I want to pick your brain maybe a little bit in a slightly different direction, and that is that I'm always been a great believer that any tragedy, if it can be prevented, is certainly cheaper and better for us. And I know that there are situations where if we can eliminate getting into homelessness, it's not only it's better for the system and it's probably less costly, but it also creates less trauma for the individual and the family itself. And so because you have so much direct contact with a lot of these people, and you may not know this, but I'm wondering if you have any idea on trends or things that have some similarities into what led up to homelessness, and if there is anything that we could do. And it could be, as you said before, there's so many varied, but if you have any insight, that would really be helpful, I think, for this committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Horsfield.
Yeah, thank you for that. I really appreciate the perspective that question brings to the bigger issues at hand. And there are as many stories as there are people. And if there is one thing that we are going to pay attention to as far as that's concerned, I know this isn't the right committee and the right bill, but there is a statewide rental subsidy program that is being proposed because the rent's too damn high, Representative, in all due respect. At the end of the day, housing affordability is the problem. And we've got that, because I tell you what, the machine that we've got built, if you will, you know, this crisis response system for people in shelter and the great work that a lot of agencies similar to Simpson are doing, moving people back into stable housing. I mean, it is really highly efficient and increasingly effective every year. And so getting the folks that are currently homeless back into housing, that's not what keeps me up at night. What keeps me up at night is the thousands upon thousands of households across the state that are cost burdened, that are just one, you know, medical crisis, one bad incident at work, one family blow up away from needing our services. Because that's what happens each year, is that we as a community move thousands of people back into stable housing, and then right behind them, people are losing housing at you know, roughly an equivalent rate.
Thank you very much for that. Anything else, Representative Petersburg?
No, thank you. I think that answers it. I think anytime we can hear perspectives on what we can do to prevent it is better, and it's actually in part of our committee. So title actually of our committee. So I think that's great for us to do that. We just can't, I don't think we're going to, as a state, be able to build ourselves out of this problem just by providing additional buildings. I think we have to figure out how people can stay self-sufficient and move forward. So thank you for that, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you so much, Representative Petersburg. I feel like that you just asked like the question that our committee is asking, right? Like just broadly. So thank you for keeping us focused on what we're really doing here. So the final thing, just before, it doesn't look like there are any further questions, but while you're before our committee, I just wanted to like repeat the placement rate at the Navigation Center, 170 people. And these, as Mr. Horsfield said, people who were had been living outside for sometimes for months, for years, people who had experienced intergenerational homelessness, people who were in very active drug, a substance use disorder, opioids, like the heaviest, you know, acute mental health crises, physical health crises. I mean, like some of the heaviest burdens that you see, some of the most difficult communities to serve. And this project over 5 months was able to place 100 of the 170 people in permanent housing. And it, that kind of placement rate is just like, I mean, it's unheard of, right, Steve? Like in, it's it, that's not what you, you don't see like a 60% placement rate for anybody kind of. So I just wanted to lift that up because I feel like we're in this, you know, we're in this moment of being able to think a little bit differently about shelter and about how to meet people's needs and how to really meet people where they are, and that everybody, no matter what kind of position that you're in your life, if we can get you into a stable housing situation, like it's it, it creates the container in which other good things can happen. So I just wanted to thank you for that. I don't know if you have anything else you wanted to share before you go.
No, I think I really, really appreciate the, I mean, some of the questions, I really appreciate the perspective. I mean, you're asking about the things that matter and why are we here and why are we having, you know, I mean, those, this is excellent. So I really appreciate all of that perspective. Again, in due respect to my colleagues from the Coalition from the Homeless that are here, this, you know, we are one part of a much bigger fabric of really vital work that's happening around this. So I appreciate you you giving me the opportunity to be here, be heard, because of the fact that we are we have a very specific ask and we're at this shovel ready state. So so thank you so much, Chair Gomez, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Representative New Brindley's hand just popped up. If you can hold on another second, Mr. Horsfield.
I'm so sorry. Thank you so much, please. Madam Chair, for giving me the latitude. But what you said, Mr. Horsfield, jogged another question. You know, like you said, there is, there are so many people working in the space and we're trying to accommodate different things. I am actually really struck by what you said that, I mean, it, in a very unscientific way, right? Because like you said, people are people and therefore we can only apply so much science to it. But I think it's really interesting that you said that it's approximately a 90-day cycle, right? That's approximately what it takes. And so, you know, like you just said, that there are other people working in the space and maybe focusing on different things. I guess that really does beg the question. You described your facilities as sort of an extended stay facility, and as opposed to, I suppose, just emergency shelter space that would be very short term. Overall, and I think everyone on this committee, we are still taking in so much information and trying to wrap our heads around what is happening overall. But when you talk about how it takes about 90 days on average, obviously there are people who take much longer. Some people I assume could even be shorter. It seems like this model is a good model for a semi-emergency situation. So how does this fit in to the bigger picture? And do we actually need perhaps more shelter space similar to this as opposed to that, you know, space that gives you a warm bed for a night, as opposed to this space that it seems like you actually have some success, right? Like, you know, you sort of know the stew and how to get people into stable housing. Is this actually what we need to see more of? I mean, I'm just trying to wrap my head around the idea. One thing that I'm really focused on in this committee is trying to figure out what is working, what do we need to amplify, what do we need to invest in, and what is not working as well, and maybe we need to let go of some of the ideas of the past. I want to amplify those things that are working. And how does this fit into that?
Mr. Horsfield.
That's a big question, I know.
No.
This is great.
So what you're getting at, and you probably will appreciate this when I say it, is that when we started operating a single front door for the shelter system 5 years ago at the Adult Shelter Connect, one of the first things we got was good data, right? So now we know who's coming, and who's staying and who's getting out and all that kind of stuff. And so the current model is built, so part of the answer that you're looking for to your question is to say that we know that about half the people who seek out emergency shelter, they come and go on their own, if you will, in a period of less than 2 weeks. So maybe it's somebody who's working day labor and they've missed a couple of checks. Maybe it's someone who had some sort of major, you know, kind of family fallout situation, whatever a case may be. But people are resilient. And so we, so roughly half of our capacity is what we want to do is we want to make sure that folks have someplace that's safe, that's relatively inexpensive for us to operate and for them to be able to get in and out of their own volition fairly quickly. And God bless them. Right. If that's the case, cause that's what our data shows us. So that is how we use the more institutional shelter settings, if you will, is in that way. And then on the backside of that, all of our shelter managers, they meet once a week and they say, hey, this guy Steve is in the big institutional shelter. He's been there for 2 weeks. He ain't going anywhere without some help. You know, we need to get him moved over to the extended stay model. You know, when is there a bed open at Simpson or one of the other smaller shelters where we can get him moved? So that's kind of how that stuff works. And so that's I think I've already answered the big chunk of the data question that you had, which is to say that there is truly, you know, when we say that shelters should ideally, you hear some language being used. I'm sure you guys have already heard it, you know, about homelessness should be non-recurring, should be short, you know, those sorts of things. There's a portion of it, which is, you know, this, we know, based on what we've seen, that there are some folks who are going to come through, who are going to need a place to lay their head for a couple of weeks and for us to stay out of their way. And off they go.
Great. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just as a follow-up, I think that's interesting. So you said that the shelter managers, so you're saying like sort of this network of all of these shelters, you guys are meeting frequently and talking about folks and helping to figure out how you guys can work together to best help individuals move through this system.
Correct. And the I should also make one shout out because this is a name that you all will know. To some degree, that degree of collaboration, those sorts of meetings are a direct product of one person by the name of Kathy Tembrook, who kind of built that structure for us before she came to the state level.
Great. And so that's the Adult Shelter Connect is sort of the way that you guys run is the mechanism for kind of that everybody sort of gathers around.
Adult Shelter Connect is the single entry point for adults seeking shelter in Hennepin County, and it is one of the kind of features of our shelter collaborative of partner organizations working together.
Great, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you for allowing the extra questions, Madam.
Yeah, no, and I think that this like we are going to continue to have these conversations about what is and isn't working in shelter as we go through this session. So thank you. All right. Well, with that, thank you so much for being with us today, Mr. Horsfield. I feel like everybody who comes in front of the committee, I'm like, when it's safe, we want to come visit, but when it's safe, we want to come visit. And, you know, just for our members to kind of get a feel, I know members of the bonding committee did get to come and kind of see what you guys are working with and the limitations of your physical space, which wasn't designed for the way it's being used right now. So thank you so much for being here, and we're gonna try our hardest to fill that gap because we know now is the time we need to get your project done. So thank you so much. Now I'm gonna pass the fake gavel over to Vice Chair Keeler for our next bill.
Thank you, Chair. Next on the agenda, we have House File 3090. This bill was referred to us from the General Register. Chair Gomez, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move that House File 3090 be referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy.
Sounds good. We have House File 3090 before us. Chair Gomez, please present your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So, you know, I kind of have talked about this in my introductory remarks, but this is our request for shelter capital money. It's $75 million to use statewide. I wonder if Sean can just can put up the map of existing emergency shelter in our state. So this is just kind of a you know, it's not perfect. We know that this isn't going to capture every emergency shelter, because as we've discussed many times in our committee, you know, this emergency sort of response to homelessness is kind of not really a coordinated system as such. It is, you know, local communities responding to emergencies. There are a lot of efforts that are, you know, completely independent, not supported by state or federal dollars or local, you know, kind of tax dollars, and others that are a mix. But this does just give you an idea. I mean, if you look down, you know, there's 28, this is just a number of shelters, and it's by county. We didn't want to put specific locations on the map because, you know, there are domestic violence shelters and other things where we want to keep the location private. But you see that, you know, there's 28 shelters in Hennepin, there's 16 in Ramsey, there's 17 in St. Louis counties. But outside of that, you know, is that Olmsted with 5? But there's really, you know, there are some counties where there are no emergency shelters. There are some where you would have to travel hundreds of miles, literally, to access community shelters. I think Representative Petersburg, I think there are 2 shelters in Steele County, the entire county. I don't think there are any emergency shelters in Representative New Brindley's district, or Representative David's districts down in southern Minnesota. And so, you know, as I said, this is consistently one of, you know, the top requests that we hear from our emergency providers, from our frontline people who are working day to day with those experiencing homelessness in our communities, is that there isn't enough space. And it's not just that, it's also that, you know, there are places that are inadequate. Like, I went to visit Simpson with the bonding folks, and you know, I mean, people are staying in a gym with kind of dividers. You know, they have a kitchen space there, but it doesn't quite like meet their needs. So there are existing facilities that need capital help to really provide that level of service that Mr. Horsfield was talking about, that kind of can, you know, so that there's space for meetings with clients, space for therapy, kind of the various like needs that people have can be met in that place. So that we can move them, you know, get them to a place where they're ready to access permanent housing. And then there's just this real serious, like, kind of regional disparity in just access. And I talked at the beginning about some of the impacts of that, and the ways that the impacts that that an individual experiences, a family experiences, the disruption in their lives. You know, if you have a family, you're moving your child away from your school, you're moving away from family, away from, you know, religious communities, away from the place that you know. And then it's also like that counties like mine and Representative Hollins's county and city are also, you know, effectively dealing with emergency homelessness response for the entire state. And that's hard on us as well, right? So that's kind of the picture. I mean, in the end, you know, the thing about this is that it's a one-time request. If we can get a pretty significant chunk of money to this in this moment, when we have a surplus, we can really make moves on this issue. And so this is a really good use of one-time dollars, which are some of the dollars that we have. And you know, I'm really hopeful that we can come together to just to acknowledge that this is the moment that we need to fill this gap that we have had for decades. So I'm going to turn it over to testifiers, Madam Chair, if that's okay. There are a few testifiers I have.
Yep, I think you have a couple. So we'll start with Rhonda Odison. If you can please let us know your name and your organization for the record before your testimony. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Vice Chair Keeler. My name is Rhonda Odison, Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. MCH is a statewide advocacy organization with over 70 member organizations across the state. With those members, we work to generate policies, community support, and local resources for housing and services to end homelessness in Minnesota. MCH is also a part of the Homes for All Coalition, joining over 270 endorsing organizations from across the state that work together to advocate for solutions that span the full continuum of homelessness to homeownership, including prevention. A significant investment in the development, acquisition, and rehabilitation of shelter beds across the state will create safe indoor spaces for individuals and families sleeping outside or staying in unsafe conditions. Investing into shelter is an equity issue. Black, Indigenous, and people of color experience homelessness at much higher rates than the white population. According to the most recent data from the Statewide Homelessness Management Information System, Black Minnesotans are just over 5% of the general population, but represent 36% of people experiencing homelessness. And for the Native and Indigenous population in our state, they are 1% of the population, but represent 18% of people experiencing homelessness. This investment will also allow for the development of culturally appropriate and low barrier shelters that are really essential in advancing housing stability in communities of color and across the state. Over the past 2 years, the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless has worked closely with our community leaders all across the state to identify and address unsheltered homelessness. MCH staff have gathered detailed information about the projects, and we are constantly learning of new shelter projects, searching for the necessary resources to bring children, families, adults, veterans, and seniors inside the shelter. Next, I'd like to call your attention to the document in your packet called Statewide Emergency Shelter Capital Needs Assessment. As noted, there are 51 projects ready to be funded with a funding gap of almost $100 million. One important nuance to note is that there are 10 projects that don't have a defined cost, so the $100 million is a close estimate. These investments would create and preserve 2,013 shelter beds through the construction, acquisition, or rehabilitation of existing spaces. 827 new beds would be created, and 1,186 beds would be preserved. There are a wide range of different shelter projects as noted in the middle part of this document, including culturally specific domestic violence shelters, youth shelters, family shelters, single adult shelters, and you can see those broken out there. And if you look at the geographic distribution of the shelter projects, you can also see that every single region in Minnesota has identified a need for shelter projects. And finally, there is a breakdown at the bottom of this document that lays out the different acquisition, rehabilitation, and construction projects that we have heard about. For many shelters that have never had access to county or state funding, they are seeking to address deferred maintenance, for example, a roof or plumbing, updating accessibility for people with mobility challenges or sensory needs, and transforming spaces so they're more resilient as COVID-19 continues to rage on, and creating spaces that are private for families and guests. We know that shelter saves lives and housing ends homelessness. And until we have enough quality homes for children, adults, and seniors in our state, shelter is a critical piece of the housing continuum. Every child, every adult, and every senior should have the safety and shelter they need as they work towards getting into a permanent home. Thank you for your time, and my colleagues and I are available for any questions that you may have.
Thank you. We will move on to the next testifier, Rose Surma. Again, if you can introduce your name, title, and organization, and then Nikki, you're on deck. Go ahead, Rose.
Good morning. Well, I guess it's starting to be more afternoon, but thank you, Committee Chair Gomez and Vice Chair Keeler and committee members. I really appreciate being here today. My name is Rose Surma, and I'm the Executive Director for OASIS Central Minnesota. We are a nonprofit organization providing emergency shelter in Morrison County, Minnesota, for both individuals and families experiencing homelessness. Currently, we're the only organization that's providing emergency shelter in Morrison County and much of the surrounding areas. Additionally, there is no women's shelter or domestic violence shelter located in our county, so we're often providing shelter for those fleeing family violence. Each night we provide shelter for someone that is a day that person is safe from the elements, safe from violence, safe from financial exploitation, safe from sexual exploitation, safe from an environment filled with illegal drugs, safe from becoming a victim of human trafficking. I appreciate being here to talk about the work we are doing and ways that we can expand what we're doing through your support and more efficiently and effectively serve those experiencing homelessness and housing insecurity. Currently, Oasis Central Minnesota provides emergency shelter through a local motels, as well as a rented duplex with two apartments. Our clients' length of stay is 30 to 90 days, but I'll echo that it's typically right around 90 and more than 90 lately that folks are staying with us. And while they stay with us, they work with our case managers to help transition to safe, permanent, affordable housing and connect to community resources. A goal our organization has been working towards since 2008 by building our organizational capacity and working within our community and with our local and governmental representatives has been to acquire a property of our own for shelter. Acquisition of a property would be a benefit for several reasons. It would be more financially efficient, and we would have the opportunity to utilize space that is specifically designed for shelter. It would also allow us to make some improvements to the space. A large barrier we have encountered is that at this time, we do not have any access to any space that is accessible to persons with mobility challenges. Neither the apartment nor any of the motels we are able to use is arranged to accommodate for physical disabilities. When we are working with individuals or a household where a family member is in need of such a space, we have to work with them to find placement outside of the community, which brings availability, transportation challenges, as well as individuals having to relocate out of their home community where they have support and resources. These are large challenges that we do experience. Just prior to the pandemic, our organization identified an available site that with funds for purchase of the property could be immediately operational. If funding were available, we could expand our operations through acquisition of the property for more efficient, effective, and expanded shelter resources in our community. I hope you will join me in supporting shelter capital funding through House File 3090. This is a crucial investment toward ending homelessness in Minnesota. Thank you for your time, and I am available for any questions you may have.
I don't see any questions at this time. Thank you for that. We'll move on to Nikki Mabry. Again, if you can do your name, title, and organization, and then John Cole, you're on deck.
Good morning, Representative Keeler and committee members. My name is Nikki Mabry. I'm a mixed-race, Black, queer femme living in occupied Dakota Territory we otherwise understand as downtown St. Paul. I'm a long-haul community organizer, recovering lobbyist, and a former legislative staffer, now proud to serve as the community engagement manager for People Serving People. But 20 years ago, I was a young adult in Duluth, Minnesota, faced with some really hard choices. The summer after my sophomore year at the College of St. Scholastica, I was asked to reconsider my academic options. Now, in my family, one simply does not just walk away from college. I didn't feel like I could go home to my parents who had worked tirelessly to support our shared dream of college for me. I felt I had no other choice than to go without secure housing in Duluth. I now recognize that I had choices, and that's a privilege that most of the folks we serve do not have. But so in the summer of 2002, I crashed on a lot of couches, frequented the food shop at Chum, sometimes slept in a car out at the Point, and knew that I could get a hot meal at the Damiano if I needed it, all while I figured out what came next. Going into shelter was not an option for me. I didn't consider it. I had reasoned that if a Black queer kid from the sticks couldn't get affirmation and welcome in the halls of a great big college, that shelter was going to be tougher. I felt this constant crushing expectation that my job was to be brown and grateful in systems like these. And we can and must do better by BIPOC. Now, 20 years ago, People Serving People was moving into 614 South 3rd Street in the Gateway District of Minneapolis. That's a neighborhood that our community has helped shape. People Serving People operates the largest and most comprehensive shelter in Minnesota for families experiencing homelessness. We are dedicated to preventing childhood, youth, and family homelessness. Last night, 231 people stayed with us. That's about 74 families. We work alongside folks in the midst of their experience of homelessness and are part of the movement to prevent that experience through both program and policy. When it's right for you, we'd love to invite the committee for a visit. Now, I don't have to tell you that both the building and I have aged since 2002, right? Our shelter facility is very well maintained. It's cared for so well by our brilliant operations team. And also, it's in need of significant updates to guarantee a healthy and safe environment for families in years to come. We seek to move beyond repairs and maintenance to make value-driven facility improvements that center trauma responsiveness and the dignity and voices of our families. So we can be here to provide shelter for families in the next 20 years. We also support the broader goal of meeting people's needs through more culturally specific shelters rather than a one-size-fits-all white dominant culture model. This would have helped me choose shelter so long ago. I hope you'll join me in supporting shelter capital funding through House File 3090. It's a crucial investment toward ending homelessness here in Minnesota. Thank you for your time, and I'm available for questions you may have.
Thank you for that testimony. I also just want to say I appreciate that you acknowledge that downtown is on Dakota Lane. We'll move on. Next is John Cole.
Good morning to you, Vice Chair Keeler and Chair Gomez, and to you, colleague members of the Preventing Homelessness Division. My name is John Cole, and I'm the Executive Director of CHOM in Duluth. I'm grateful for this opportunity to speak today in support of HF 3090. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in a crisis. Our shelters across the state have for some time reported being overwhelmed by a demand that seems unstoppable in the face of increasing homelessness numbers. 80 of our 87 counties in Minnesota report that their shelters are operating beyond capacity. CHOM operates the largest emergency shelter north of the Twin Cities. We open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, welcoming between 900 and 1,100 overnight guests each year, some as far as the Twin Cities. But we are not immune. We too operate in this crisis. Unsheltered homelessness in our county has increased steadily over the last 13 years by 37%. We have only 155 shelter units in the city of Duluth, and over 600 persons living dangerously, some in the cold without a roof over their heads, under the freeway, in vehicles, in abandoned buildings or fish houses, or doubled up on couches or floors. We are unable to shelter them. We do the best we can, but there simply isn't enough room. Our shelters are already full of persons on the coordinated entry list, waiting sometimes up to 2 years for a housing option. Our city has calculated that it needs 3,800 affordable homes by 2030. But annual housing development is nowhere close to meeting that goal. In fact, the COVID-19 pandemic has seriously derailed those plans. So while we recognize that housing is the ultimate solution, we know that the homeless cannot wait. They need shelter now. When that grandmother who was experiencing homelessness came to us last week because she had gained custody of her imprisoned daughter's 11-day-old baby, they needed shelter now. Our citizens need a place to stay while they wait for housing to be developed. And because of the twin crises of housing and homelessness that confront us, CHOM, together with the homeless service providers of Duluth, have developed a bold, ambitious plan to address unsheltered homelessness in Duluth over the next 5 years. It's called Stepping On Up. It is a three-phase, $33 million plan that would result in the building of private, dignified, small-scale, culturally specific, stabilizing and transforming accommodation and increased numbers of outreach personnel and homeless service providers. The first two phases require shelter capital. Phase one would see the creation of authorized living zones for persons who choose or are forced to be outside. In particular, we want to develop a shelter for persons who live in vehicles. This shelter, in effect an upgraded parking lot, would offer safety and security, waste receptacles, restrooms, and the opportunity to connect privately with outreach workers and services. Phase two, another shelter capital project, would see the creation of 100 Shelter Next units modeled after the Aviva Indoor Village project, offering safe, secure, private, dignified shelter and services to support stabilization goals. The third phase provides 200 tiny home transformation units, but that is outside the scope of this body's shelter capital consideration. Stepping On Up will profoundly impact our homelessness and housing crises. You can find information about it at steppingonupduluth.org. I hope you will join me in supporting significant shelter capital funding through House File 1390. This is a crucial investment towards ending homelessness here in Minnesota. Thank you for your time. I'm available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. I believe we still have two public testifiers. We'll move to those and then we'll do questions at the end, Chair Hornstein, if that's okay with you. We'll move on to our public testifiers. First, we have Tiki Brown. If you can identify who you are, your title, and your organization.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, Vice Chair Keeler, members of the committee. My name is Tiki Brown, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. I'd like to thank you for considering this important investment in the state's shelter facility infrastructure and for the opportunity to comment on the legislation before the committee today. Despite many efforts to increase short and medium-term rental assistance and affordable housing options, the ongoing presence and increasing rate of unsheltered individuals and families across the state highlights the critical role of emergency shelters in the continuum of services for those experiencing homelessness. As the committee has heard today, and in testimony last week from our colleagues at the Interagency Council of Homelessness, unsheltered Minnesotans remain the fastest growing segment of the homeless population. Unsheltered homelessness grew by 145% from 2014 to 2020, based on current point in time count data. Moreover, we know that this is a statewide problem. Unsheltered homelessness doubled in greater Minnesota communities from 2014 to 2020. The historic underinvestment in shelter in urban communities, in small towns, and in rural areas across the state mean that in many parts of Minnesota, there are still no viable shelter options, or the options that exist are operating at full capacity, are underfunded, or are in need of extensive repair, renovation, or improvement. Providers' response to the COVID-19 pandemic has already strained underfunded shelter facilities, exacerbating the need for significant investments in our shelter infrastructure and additional beds statewide. We know that access to emergency shelter not only offers a place to stay, but serves as a vital connection to the coordinated entry system of services and future housing stability for adults, youth, and families experiencing homelessness. This investment in shelter infrastructure aligns with the governor's capital budget request for shelter facility acquisition, construction, and renovation, and represents an important step in our collective efforts to end homelessness in our state. I'd like to thank you, Chair Gomez, as well as the advocates who have worked so hard to bring this bill before committee. Thank you for your time and for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for sharing your testimony. I know, is Sue Watla Phillips on? I know she had to step away.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Go ahead, Sue. Please tell us your name, organization, and title.
Thanks, Vice Chair Keeler and Chair Gomez and committee members. I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and President of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Been working on housing and homelessness for over 54 years, was homeless as a teenager. And MICA's mission is to ensure that everyone without exception has a safe, decent, accessible home that is affordable to them. Over half of our board are people that and staff have experienced homelessness, and 70% of our board and staff are from diverse communities. Our MICA members are actively involved in our communities to address the immediate needs of people at risk or experiencing homelessness. Our primary goals are to prevent homelessness and to have homes that are affordable for everyone. But it's critical that we reinvest in our emergency shelter system. For some of us that were around in the late 70s and early 80s, we really believed that we would correct this situation and not be in our fifth decade of growing homelessness as we are in this nation. And so while we did create resources in the early 80s to help the shelter system, those dollars are not available now for our shelters. We want to make sure that people that experience homelessness have access to a low barrier, safe, decent, respectful place to be, and that there are wraparound services to assistance to assist them to access housing that is affordable as rapidly as possible in our community. We support the expansion of shelters to 24-hour facilities with private rooms and wraparound services. We also recognize that some communities, this may not be possible, and so they should not be precluded from getting this funding. We think that all facilities should be able to access these dollars. This funding would be the most significant state funding that we've had for shelters since 1984, when we had the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency funding the temporary housing, and when shelters and transitional housing capital funding was eligible under the Minnesota Housing State Housing Trust Fund, which was eliminated that eligibility in the early 2000s. The other federal dollars that is available for shelter is the Emergency Solution Grant, but communities have to choose whether they're gonna use that for operations and services or for capital, and so this is not a good choice. So some of the things that we would encourage as this moves forward, and not asking that it be added to legislation, but for all of the providers that would be moving forward with accessing these dollars when it's passed, is that the Shelter Residents Bill of Rights would be included. And that as we are creating, as we are building these shelters and rehabbing shelters, is that the jobs would pay livable wages, and that we would employ folks that have experienced homelessness and from diverse communities and people with lower incomes. And that we make sure that the staffing of our different organizations have a diversity of staff, including people that have experienced homelessness, as well as on their board. We thank you very much for your support, and Chair Gomez for bringing forward House File 3090, and encourage you to pass this. And just want to tell you that I just came off a national call where people were just, they said, can you import this into our state? And I just want to let Chair Gomez know that her rental assistance bill that passed last year in tax committee is now becoming a model for the federal and other states too. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And I agree, it's nice when we can be a state that's moving forward in some of these areas that other states can look at, because we do need to make massive changes. I know Chair Hornstein, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to comment, I have a question for Mr. Cole, but I wanted to just thank Ms. Watlow Phillips for her testimony and for pointing out that how important and critical and urgent this bill is. And I strongly support it, Chair Gomez. And Mr. Cole, I appreciated your comments. I'm just such a strong supporter of CHUM, and folks on this committee know how much I appreciate the model of the Steve O'Neill Apartments. And I, again, at Chair Gomez, it's, you know, talking about models, I think the work you did on tiny, on the Tiny Villages project, you know, now is being replicated across the state here with Mr. Cole's testimony. But I was reminded that the Steve O'Neill Apartments project had a variety of different funding sources. And I'm wondering if you could maybe outline, and I think we definitely, I think as a state, have a key role. I think there was some bonding money in that project. I recognize the key role we have as a state in helping support the vision that you've laid out, you know, with the $33 million. What other sources of funding are you looking at, you know, for, you know, your project, the Stepping On Up project, which I find very inspiring.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Hornstein. We are seeking to build a multi-sector coalition to support the Stepping On Up proposal. We are looking for funding from the city, the county, and state and federal funds. We have sought partnerships and have gotten commitments from the Chamber of Commerce and the Downtown Council as well, and the private sector. Our collaboration with our 44 congregations that had supported us are also key players in developing Stepping On Up, and will be contributing funding towards this.
Thank you so much.
Hornstein, did you have any follow-up?
No, I don't have a follow-up. I do want to correct myself. I think I referred to this as tiny villages. The correct term of art is indoor villages, I believe. So I wanted to state that on the record. But thank you, Mr. Cole, and I hope that we can step up with a stage share for this, and I appreciate your continued incredible work.
Thank you. You'd be most welcome.
Lee New Brinley, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a few questions. And I think my questions are for Chair Gomez. And I'm wondering, I don't know, last year we got some really good information. And it seems like the folks, I remember particularly the presentation from the city of Ramsey County. And they really had a very good handle on the number of unhoused homeless people they had. Do you know, have you been in touch with these folks? Do we have updated numbers? Like, do we know what the unhoused homeless population is right now?
Chair Gomez?
I know there's been a lot of fluctuation, obviously, with COVID, and there were resources and things. I know that there's been a ton in flux.
So some things I know and some things I don't know. St. Paul continues. My understanding the last time that I spoke with them was that they continue within the city to really like monitor and maintain a list, like they know exactly kind of who's in which encampment. My understanding is that, you know, there are many, many more people in that situation in Minneapolis than there are in St. Paul, frankly. It's kind of, it's 10 times more or something like that, right? And so Minneapolis doesn't have that kind of level of data. The point in time count, which is sort of like, you know, the way that we track homelessness broadly, was just like completed a couple weeks ago. And so we don't have those new numbers. I know that, I think this is actually one of the things that the money that we passed out of our committee last year, the emergency services program, which I think was Representative Howard's bill that we got into the HHS, you know, it was part of the final deal at, you know, a lower level. But one of the things I know that money was accessed for at least 2 years ago was to do like a census at encampments. And Avivo, who runs the indoor villages, is one organization that does that. So I know that there is like, I have heard, near North Encampment, there's 24 people staying there now. There are organizations, service providers who kind of like know who's where, but there isn't a sort of centralized place that is held, if that makes sense. And again, I don't know everything about the question, but that's what I do know.
New Brinley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Gomez. And I know that at this point, I'm guessing a lot of it would be anecdotal through conversations that we don't know everything yet. I guess, you know, I continue to have some frustration, and I will probably ask you this at every committee in hopes that you'll be able to track down the information that we need. But I really do think that as a committee, we need an accounting of, I mean, we know that a ton of money was dumped into this space over the last couple of years. And I think we need an accounting of that. What happened with it? What problems did it solve? What problems did it not solve in the midst of all of this? I just think we are constantly making proposals to make changes, but we still don't know what we need to know to move forward on so much of this stuff. And I guess another more general question I would have, and Mr. Horsfield mentioned this again, and we heard this last year as well, that the total population of homeless people at any given time remains relatively constant. And as they move people out of homelessness into stable housing, new people come into homelessness. But that number over time is relatively constant. And I'm wondering if we can speak to that right now. And, you know, I mean, obviously this has gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of years because of the encampments, but clearly there were unhoused people before. Like, where were people before versus where are they now? And is that number of outgoing and incoming still relatively constant?
I think that's a great question. I see Tiki Brown has her hand up. I don't know if she has some data from DHS to share.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a little bit of data I just wanted to share really briefly. We do know from our 2020 point in time count, which is done every January, and like you mentioned, Representative, it fluctuates, that 2,000 Minnesotans were experiencing unsheltered homelessness statewide. Now, because of the pandemic, our 2021 data, you know, will not occur just because so many folks were not able to do that count. And then I would also offer that we're happy to share an accumulation of maps and charts with the committee afterward with some data that show some of the fluctuations and additional points.
Gomez, did you want to follow up on that question at all?
Yeah, just briefly, and I see there are other folks want to get into. So this is like part of the complication, right, of this space, is that we hear this, there's this thing, right, that our advocates always say, housing ends homelessness, shelter saves lives. So our shelter response really is not like the thing that's going to get the number down. Our shelter response is the thing that's gonna like provide a relatively soft landing place for people who are experiencing acute crises in their lives. And of course, right, it's like housing insecurity, housing costs, stagnating wages, the crisis of mental health and substance use disorder, poverty, right? Like all these things that contribute to housing precarity in an individual or a family's lives. So I think that's where it gets like hard to be like, you know, we spent this money on this thing and it had this impact on the number, because the contributing factors are outside of the response, you know, and that's not the case for every issue that we deal with at the Capitol, right? A lot of things are sort of more quantifiable and less, varied in the contributing factors, I think, than this. And so I think that's like part of why I still feel like I personally am still trying to get my arms around the problem. As I was just like hearing from Representative Hornstein, I was like, oh, right. I've never even looked at a shelter budget and seen where they get all their money. Like there are all of these sort of baseline things that we're still trying to establish. So I'm in the space of like asking questions, and I think that you and I should have an offline conversation about maybe like some, you know, if there are things that we want to bring in front of the committee that would help scope that out more completely in the way that you're looking for, then we should have those conversations. But I appreciate the question. I don't know.
Yep. Madam Chair. New Brindley, do you have a follow-up? We just need to do our vote in 2 minutes.
I do. Well, I do. I will just follow up with this and then I can be done, actually. I would just say, and I agree with you, and that's the complication of this committee, right? Is that, I mean, not only are lots of different funding sources used in the space, they're used for lots of different things. I would just submit that where we are spending state dollars, there is certainly a goal for each thing we are doing. And we should be able to measure our success against that goal. understanding that each individual appropriation might have a different goal in the space, we should still be able to measure our results for each individual thing that we're doing. And we should be able to get a handle on that in totality, right? Like, if we can't, we've got a problem. As legislators, we should demand accountability, right? Like, that's part of our job. And really, the reason for that is because, again, I will go back to this over and over, we want to amplify those programs that are showing success. And there are lots of different programs with lots of different goals. And we want to make sure that we're amplifying those that work. Since we just have a moment, I will just say, on this bill today, I have some concerns about the bill. A question would be to consider moving forward. This is a grant program to be administered by DHS. It is not clear in the language of the bill. Does this fit inside the structure of an existing grant program? Would this require a new grant program? That is something to consider. I'm very concerned about line 2.13, that grants can pay for 100% of a total project. I've been here 5 years. I know that's not super long, but I don't know that I have ever seen the state pay 100% of a project. Usually, typically, our partners need to have some skin in the game, and I would suggest that that's an important piece. Everyone needs to be invested here and have some skin in the game. I think that that is critical. The other thing that I will just flag as a real concern in this language is line 2.17 says the commissioner may use a competitive request for proposal process. I think that needs to be clearly defined, how the commissioner is to administer these funds. I don't think it's reasonable to say that, well, they can use a competitive process or not. They can do whatever they want. That's how we end up with shady dealings that we don't want to have on our hands, right? Like, we don't want to be responsible for that. The last thing I would ask, I also serve on the state government committee, and I think it's really important for us to understand how much of this $75 million can go to administrative costs at the department. We need to know those things. I think that there are a lot of big question marks about this. I'm not comfortable with the language as it stands. I think that there's some pretty significant questions that need to be answered. So I'll be a no vote today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, New Brindley. Chair Gomez, do you have any quick closing comments?
Just to say that we have another committee stop, so I appreciate that feedback from Representative New Brindley, and we'll be looking into it. I just thank the committee for the time and consideration. As you have heard, the need is great. The time is now for us to move and to really kind of make a difference in this space. So thank you very much. I'd appreciate your support. And I renew my motion to move House File 3090 to Human Services, Finance, and Policy.
Hearing no further discussion, Chair Gomez will renew her motion that House File 3090 is referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. The Legislative Assistant will now take the roll.
Chair Gomez.
Gomez, aye.
Gomez, aye. Vice Chair Keeler.
Keeler, aye.
Vice Chair Keeler, aye. Lead New Brindley.
No.
Lead New Brindley, nay. Davids.
Davids, no.
Davids, no. Heinrich.
Heinrich, no.
Heinrich, nay. Hollins. Hollins.
Aye.
Hollins, aye. Hornstein.
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Howard.
Howard, aye.
Howard, aye. Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg.
Petersburg, no.
Petersburg, nay. Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. There being 6 ayes, 4 nays, the motion is prevailed.
Thank you, Robin. With 6 ayes, 4 nays, this House File 3090 is referred to Human Services. With that, we are now adjourned. Thank you, everyone.